In late October 2003, the president visited Canberra, Australia, following the Asia-Pacific Economic Summit in Bangkok, Thailand, with stops in Japan, Singapore, and Indonesia. Bush met with Prime Minister John Howard, a good ally and friend. I attended the meeting in the Cabinet Room at Parliament House. Howard, despite deep division among Australians, had stood strongly behind Bush's decision to topple Saddam Hussein, persuading the Australian Parliament to commit troops in support of the American-led invasion and occupation. Bush and Howard, as usual in such a meeting, discussed a number of pressing priorities, including Iraq and transformation of the Middle East. "Thank you for being tough," Bush said to Howard, "and for your friendship. It is important to have the courage to do what is right. You've done that, John. Iraq will change the Middle East. Iran will change because of what we are doing in Iraq." Later in the meeting, one of Howard's advisors asked Bush if he thought Islamic cultures could really adopt democracy. "I think so over time," Bush replied. "I believe Iraq is the place that will help make it happen. It will evolve into a democratic free country like Turkey or like Bahrain is moving to." "I believe freedom is the deepest hope of every human heart," Bush added. "I think there are enough Muslim leaders committed to freedom to move Islamic states in that direction. I believe it is going to happen." In early November, the president welcomed Prime Minister Ranil Wickremasinghe of Sri Lanka to the White House. Bush began by thanking the prime minister for standing strong on Iraq at the most recent UN General Assembly meeting in September. Ranil had stated that the United States had no choice but to intervene militarily, leading to heavy criticism of him in the media at home. "The decisions I made were for the security concerns of America," Bush stated. "I also believe free societies are peaceful societies." He added that by dealing with Saddam Hussein, other rogue nations like North Korea knew how serious the United States was about addressing threats. 50 years from now, people will say thanks for what we are doing in Iraq," Bush said. "You have stood rock solid in the face of critics. I assure you one thing, a free and peaceful Iraq will help achieve peace in the Middle East." The consistency and prominence of the president's rhetoric in these meetings with foreign leaders was striking. It convinced me of the sincerity of his passion for the idea of implanting democracy coercively as a way of bringing peace to the Middle East. One could question the wisdom or the practicality of this plan, but not the genuineness of the personal vision that drove it. At the time, it was something powerful and hopeful I could embrace, which helped quell the uncertainties I harbored about the original decision. Communicating with the American people about the situation in Iraq was more challenging. Having been sold on the necessity of war by the argument that Saddam represented a direct and growing threat to the region, the United States, and the world, the public and the media were growing more and more skeptical as the summer wore on and no WMD were found. So we felt relieved near the end of July when the killing of Uday and Qusay Hussein, the ruthless and much-hated sons of the dictator, afforded us a brief change of focus in the media coverage. It came just in time for the president's usual midsummer news conference. This was an event typically held at the end of July, just before the president and some of us on his team headed to Crawford, Texas for the month of August. It would be Bush's first formal news conference since the invasion. The tone set by the president in discussing Iraq was always something we, his team of advisors, struggled to properly calibrate. We didn't want him to sound pessimistic, of course, but we also didn't want him to sound disconnected from the painful reality on the ground being reported by the media. With events in Iraq changing daily and unpredictably, and with frequent attacks occurring against American troops, despite the president's declaration in May that major combat operations had ended, this was a tricky line to walk. In preparing for the July press conference, we agreed that Bush would have to accept responsibility for the flawed 16 words in the State of the Union address. This would get headline attention since it was news, but we hoped we could also draw attention to some of the positive developments of recent weeks in Iraq. The president preferred a more informal briefing before the press conference. With the help of my deputy press secretaries, I would prepare questions and suggest responses so Bush could review them the evening before. Communications Director Dan Bartlett would focus on broader message points Bush should emphasize and work with the speechwriting team to get the opening statement down. There would usually be two sessions the day of the news conference where we could go through likely questions. The first would be in the Oval shortly after the president arrived or after his morning intelligence briefings. It tended to be shorter, in the 20 to 30 minute range, while the final one, closer to the scheduled time of the news conference in the Oval, would be a half hour to 45 minutes. Andy Card, Condi Rice, and Karl Rove usually attended at least one of the sessions. Bush would sit at his desk for these murder board sessions, where we'd throw the tough or killer questions at him. Bush liked bringing a little levity to the sessions, ridiculing some questions with playful responses he would never utter in public. It was a way for him to relax and get his mind focused, in much the same way that a world-class athlete might ease nervousness ahead of a crucial contest. When the game began, the president was ready. One by one, he hit all the points he'd planned to cover. On Iraq, he pointed to progress while acknowledging difficulties and calling for patience. Most of Iraq was growing more peaceful, he noted, although remnants of Saddam Hussein's regime, joined by terrorists and criminals, were making a last attempt to frighten the Iraqi people and undermine the resolve of the coalition. The rise of a free and peaceful Iraq, Bush emphasized, is critical to the stability of the Middle East, and a stable Middle East is critical to the security of the American people. The success of a free Iraq will also demonstrate to other countries in that region that national prosperity and dignity are found in representative government and free institutions. They are not found in tyranny, resentment, and support of terrorism. As freedom advances in the Middle East, those societies will be less likely to produce ideologies of hatred and produce recruits for terror. Bush alluded to the killing of Uday and Qusay, saying, "As the blanket of fear is lifted, as Iraqis gain confidence that the former regime is gone forever, we will gain more cooperation in our search for the truth in Iraq." And he expressed his confidence that the truth about WMD would confirm his decision to go to war. "We know that Saddam Hussein produced and possessed chemical and biological weapons and has used chemical weapons. We know that. He also spent years hiding his weapons of mass destruction programs from the world. We now have teams of investigators who are hard at work to uncover the truth." Bush also touched on some other issues Americans were concerned about, remembering that his father's re-election campaign had faltered in large part because of his apparent indifference to people's economic woes. "It's the economy, stupid." And thinking about the current criticism of a jobless recovery, Bush made a point of emphasizing his administration's economic accomplishments in the form of additional stimulus for taxpayers and small businesses. And for the first time, he signaled openness to the idea of a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage, a hot-button topic for Christian conservative leaders. The president had done a good job, we felt, but in the Washington game, once the press senses a politician is on the defensive, a peculiar quirk in the rules rears its head. The referees and the opposing team can appear indistinguishable. The media headlines coming out of the news conference focused on Bush's shrinking credibility, noting his denials on the charge of having oversold his case for war in Iraq. As the old political adage says, when you're defending, you're losing, and that was the uncomfortable spot Bush now found himself caught in. NBC News followed its coverage of the news conference with updated poll numbers showing that the president's approval rating had dropped from 71% in April to 56% now, while his disapproval rating had risen from 23% to 38% over the same period. On the other hand, he still held strong on the war on terrorism, with 66% approving of his handling of it, and 56% said that they felt the Democratic attacks on Bush were just plain politics. Still, the trends weren't good. If problems in Iraq continued to fester, and particularly if the human and financial cost continued to soar and the chief rationale for the war continued to unravel, it was only a matter of time before Americans began to abandon the war in droves, and with it, the administration that had staked its credibility on that war. During that summer, we had not yet abandoned hope of finding WMD. David Kaye, a respected scientist and experienced weapons inspector, provided some assurance to us privately and publicly that there was every reason to believe that damning evidence of Saddam's quest for WMD would eventually be uncovered in Iraq.